This is the third day of this January 2016 Rohatsu Sesshin. Rohatsu, most of you probably know, Rohatsu literally means the eighth day of the 12th month. And so in most Zen communities, the Rohatsu Sesshin is conducted in December. December 8th is considered the day of the Buddha's enlightenment in Zen. But the lunar calendar wouldn't have lined up in those days in the ancient Japan or China. Wouldn't have necessarily lined up with December. Could have been even in January. And I've felt for decades that I had felt for decades that having the Rohatsu Sesshin in December suffered from the holiday spirit. I felt that people just inevitably were tempted to think ahead to the holidays and gift giving and all kinds of other things. The last straw for me was long before I became a teacher, when I was still working on Mu at Arnold Park in the Sesshin, the Rohatsu Sesshin in December, and a moment of tremendous, ferocious concentration by everyone in the Zendo, that you could hear a pin drop. It was so intense in the Zendo and the silence, and we found ourselves being treated to Christmas carols right outside the window. Here we were trying to overcome birth and death, and we heard this band of merrymakers saying, "Deck the halls of boughs of holly, fa la 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 la." So for many years now, we've had it in January. Which, by the way, is when people want to get down to business and really apply themselves to the work, however they take that. So we're going to go back and to the teachings of the 12th century Chan master Yuan Wu. This is from the text Zen Letters, Teachings of Yuan Wu, translated by the Cleary brothers. And we left off in the middle of a letter yesterday. This is a collection of letters to monks and nuns and lay people, people of every kind. And here he says, "The ancients went through all sorts of experiences and faced all sorts of demons and difficulties. They took charge of their minds all the way along and made them as strong as iron or stone. Thus, when it came to passing through birth and death, they didn't waste any effort. Isn't this the special strength and generosity beyond emotionalism that truly great people possess?" The ancients went through all sorts of experiences and faced all sorts of demons and difficulties. As Sesshin goes on, we're more likely to encounter these all sorts of experiences and sorts of demons and difficulties. Sticking points in our own mind, mental attachments, fears possibly. What we go through, they've all gone, they all went through, these ancient masters. Maybe the content of some of the thoughts we have weren't quite the same, but they were the same in that they basically revolved around the self. And the I, the me, and the my. Anxieties, frustrations, discouragement. They all had to find their way through those things. They had to hang tough in the face of those things, even when they might feel like quitting. There's a passage by in the text of the Christian text, the Desert Fathers. This is from the book, The Wisdom of the Desert. And this is how it goes. In the beginning, there is struggle and a lot of work. But after that, there is indescribable joy. It's just like building a fire. At first, it's smoky and your eyes water, but later you get the desired result. I always, when I read that, I always have thought of the first half of Sesshin, getting smoke in your eyes, and also we can see that as the kind of makyo that can come up. Just largely a matter of persevering through whatever arises in the mind, the body mind, the pain, the physical pain, the emotional pain, the memories. Holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in prajna wisdom, dwelling in the breath. Dwelling in the koan, dwelling in non-dwelling. And he says they took charge of their minds all the way along and made them as strong as iron or stone. Of course, it means they were aware that at any moment they had a choice as to where to direct their attention. We can allow our attention to drift into thoughts and linger there, or we can just direct it back to this particular practice we're working on. That's taking charge of the mind. Thus, when it came to passing through birth and death, they didn't waste any effort. Isn't this the special strength and generosity beyond emotionalism that truly great people possess? Well, suppose it means that strength, what we call strength and generosity, can be a biased strength or biased generosity to some people but not to others. Or that generosity often, maybe usually, has some kind of degree of attachment behind it, attachment to being appreciated, attachment to the particular person. That's easy, it's to be generous to certain people close to you and not others. But he's talking about a great kind of a maha generosity. It doesn't have that personal attachment to it. He continues, when bodhisattvas who live a householder's life, okay, that's all of us, cultivate the practices of home leavers, it is like a lotus blooming in fire. It's a very, very... famous image in Zen, lotus blooming in the fire. It will always be hard to tame the desire for fame and rank and power and position, not to mention all the myriad starting points of vexation and turmoil associated with the burning house of worldly existence. Boy, he really nails it here. Who can honestly say that they're free of the desire for fame and rank, position, power? Anyone who makes such a claim is not seen into their nature. And the myriad starting points of vexation and turmoil associated with the householder's life, work, family, home. The only way is for you yourself to realize your fundamental, real, wondrous wholeness and reach the stage of great calm and stability and rest. In other words, awaken to your true nature. It would be best if you managed to cast off everything and be empty and ordinary. So, of course, that would be the opposite of craving fame and rank and power and position. Thoroughly experience the absence of conditioned mind and observe that all phenomena are like dreams and magical illusions. All phenomena are like dreams and magical illusions because they are in flux. All phenomena are in a state of change. They're evanescent. In that sense, this whole world of phenomena is a dream. I think it was the last seven-day sesshin, November, that I read from the late the Chinese Zen master Zibo, who said this: when you gain success and fame, it is no different from wearing a garland of flowers in a dream. When you lose success and fame, it is no different than the flowers which you wear in the dream being blown away by the wind. Moved by the vanishing of the flowers, you awaken. Upon awakening, you think back on wearing the garland of flowers in the dream. Those flowers have vanished. When you awaken, who was wearing them? What vanished? Who is it who wakes up and knows of the flowers and the vanishing? This is a perspective that is sometimes granted us in very old age, as I understand. I hear about people on their deathbed or not quite, who look back and see everything, all of their struggling and grasping and suffering as in a dream. I guess it's mostly in Zen texts that I've read about this. Sounds beautiful, sounds ethereal and so wonderful, but to actually suffer loss of, suffer failure or loss of fame, who has the equanimity to see it as a dream at that point? when you are rejected for a job, or you can't find employment, if you fail an exam, if you are rejected from a college you apply to, how many people have the equanimity to just exhale and see it for what it is, just another passing phenomenon? When you're rejected in love, someone leaves you, same thing. This is a high bar, these kinds of events. He says, be empty all the way through and continue on clearing out your mind according to the time and the situation. Then you will have the same correct foundation as all the great enlightened laymen in Buddhist tradition. One last thing about seeing things as a dream. This is something we can experience in Sesshin, and it happens through, as he says, becoming empty all the way through. When we are without thoughts in the mind, or with the thoughts are very thin, have really thinned out, there's this wonderful stillness that settles in. Then we can have these eyes of detachment and regard all these ups and downs of life with a kind of dispassion that Zibo is talking about, and here Yuan Wu is talking about. According to your own measure of power, you will transform those not yet enlightened so you can enter together into the uncontrived, uncluttered ocean of true nature. Then your life here on this earth will not be at a loss. His next letter. The essential thing in practicing the way is to make the roots deep and the stem strong. We've touched on this before in Sesshin, but just as a reminder for people who didn't hear it, the root is this no mind that we access through Zazen. We access whenever we are free of thoughts. This is the root of it all. The stem, sometimes called the branches, and leaves, are all of the secondary practices that we do that grow out of this root of no-mindedness. Devotions and rituals, ceremonies, the words, even we could say, is part of the stem or the leaves. The many uses of the discriminating mind, and also wise uses of the discriminating, what the texts sometimes refer to as discriminating wisdom. But that grows out of this realm of no mind. In Sesshin, it's primarily the root that we devote ourselves to. And then we go back to our lives, and then we have to care for the branches and leaves while still never neglecting the root practice of Zen. The essential thing in practicing the way is to make the roots deep and the stem strong. Be aware of where you really are 24 hours a day. Well, that's Zen practice and activity. Being mindful, attentive, aware. Being aware of what's going on in your mind. You must be most attentive. When nothing at all sticks to your mind, it all merges harmoniously without boundaries. The whole thing is empty and still, and there's no more doubt or hesitation in anything you do. This is called the fundamental matter appearing ready-made. As soon as you give rise to the slightest bit of dualistic perception or arbitrary understanding, and you want to take charge of this fundamental matter and act the master, then you immediately fall into the realm of the clusters of form, sensation, conception, value synthesis, and consciousness. Well, these are the five skandhas. We refer to these in the Prajnaparamita every time we chant it. Saw the emptiness of all five skandhas. The skandhas are the components of individual existence. There are different translations of these. The first is always form, our physical, corporeal self. And then there are concepts, thoughts and concepts, and there's volition or choice is another one, and then feeling or sensation, and then consciousness itself. In the Prajnaparamita we have versions, translations of these five that flow more nicely in chanting. They're not such complicated words, but they're not the most accurate translations of it. So appreciate this. If you want to take charge of this fundamental matter and act the master, then you fall into the realm of attachment to the self, the notion, the illusion of self. He's talking about control, the illusion of control, thinking that we have some ultimate control over things. Well, to say we don't have any control over our practice, the condition of our mind, is also false. It's false to say we do, and it's false to say simply that we don't. At any moment, we have a choice as to where we place our attention, where we direct our attention. We're not helpless. We're not to consign ourselves to our fate, our karma. They're not the same, but if we didn't have some way of changing ourselves, of acting, then the whole training itself would be, practice and training would be pointless. We do, by the choices we make, moment by moment, starting with the mind, how we use or misuse the mind. It's just that it's only up to a point. We do what we can. As I quoted T.S. Eliot yesterday, I think, for us there is only the trying. Well, the trying means a lot. We can make greater or lesser effort. And our mandate as practitioners of the Dharma is to, at any moment, make our fullest effort. He continues, you are entrapped. This is people who think that they're the boss of everything. You are entrapped by seeing, hearing, feeling, and knowing, by gain and loss and right and wrong. You are half drunk and half sober and unable to clean all this up. This is where the practice comes in, to turn over, to put all of our effort into giving to the koan or the breath, whatever our practice is. Frankly speaking, you simply must manage to keep concentrating even in the midst of clamor and tumult, acting as though there were not a single thing happening, penetrating all the way through from the heights to the depths. You must become perfectly complete without any shapes or forms at all, without wasting effort yet not inhibited from acting. Whether you speak or stay silent, whether you get up or lie down, it is never anyone else. This concentrating, even in the midst of clamor and tumult, makes me think of some of the noisier periods of sesshin. Beginners sometimes come to a sesshin expecting luscious silence for 7 days and can really be thrown off balance by the intermittent noise in the zendo, starting with the noise of the stick and then the doksan rushes. Sometimes takes them a while to get their footing. But this is valuable practice to be able to maintain one's center in disturbances. It's a kind of false strength to develop concentration only, to be able to maintain concentration only in ideal conditions. Well, sesshin is pretty darn close to ideal. But then we get to test that concentration at times of noise and commotion. Good. It's after a while. It's an acquired ability. You learn after a while that you don't need to get involved with what you hear. That right there in the midst of it, we have this ability to maintain our focus. Sometimes use the example of athletes. Athletes have this ability. These are athletes who are performing in front of big crowds. They learn to be centered, no matter what the conditions are. In the basketball court, a big game with 10,000-15,000 people in the stands, and the player gets one or two free throws. He stands, and his teammates and the opposing team are lined up, and if it's one of the member of the visiting team, not the home team, then the fans behind the hoop will raise hell visually. They got all kinds of things that are trying to distract the thrower, the free thrower. Now, he doesn't, no athlete would say, all right, I am not going to make this free throw until everyone is quiet. No, I'm serious. That's only fair now. Please, silence everybody. If athletes can do that, people in any kind of worldly occupation, surely we must be able to do it. You can find your way to what the poet Shelley referred to as a sweet spot of glassy quiet amidst the battling tide. The eye of the hurricane. The real opportunity, let's call it an opportunity to practice this, is during the loud mooing and hooing on the last night of Sesshin, where you can find yourself, another poet, enclosed in the tumultuous privacy of storm. This last line, whether you speak or stay silent, whether you get up or lie down, it is never anyone else. Meaning, there's no other, no self-consciousness, no self or other. He continues, if you become aware of getting it all stuck or blocked, this is all false thought at work. Meaning, if you describe yourself as stuck, then this is still just a notion that's you're enthralled to, an idea. Make yourself completely untrammeled, like empty space, like a clear mirror on its stand, like the rising sun lighting up the sky. Moving or still, going or coming, it doesn't come from outside. It doesn't come from outside. Let go and make yourself independent and free, not being bound by things and not seeking to escape from things. From beginning to end, fuse everything into one whole. Where has there ever been any separate worldly phenomenon apart from the Buddha Dharma, or any separate Buddha Dharma apart from worldly phenomena? Not being bound by things. If we are completely absorbed in our practice, there's no bondage. We're free then. And not seeking to escape from things. Well, so if we're with that kind of thing in mind, where there still is these two-ness. I would rather not be here. I'd rather be there. I'd rather it not be now. I'd rather it be then, in the future. This is thoughts. This is why the founder of Zen pointed directly to the human mind. Bodhidharma. This is why the Diamond Sutra taught the importance of human beings detaching from forms, above all, thought forms. To develop this essential insight, it is best to spend a long time going back into yourself and investigating with your whole being so that you can arrive at the stage of the genuine experience of enlightenment. This is what it means to practice with boundless, infinite, enlightened teachers everywhere in every moment. He's referring to our own self-nature, our own essential, true nature, and infinite, enlightened teachers everywhere in every moment. We all have those teachers as our own true self. Notice he says, it is best to spend a long time going back into yourself. He's not saying, make it as fast as possible. See how quickly you can get this behind you. No. He understands that anything of true value takes time. Takes time. Maturation. The reward, the harvest, is commensurate with the process of slow, true process of maturation. This is one of the big handicaps we as Americans have, is our craving for the quick fix. I think it's fair characterization of Americans as being so attached to getting quick results, whatever it takes. It doesn't work that way. He quotes now the great Yentao, or Ganto in Japanese. Abandoning things is superior, pursuing things is inferior. Obviously, thoughts would apply there. Abandoning thoughts is superior, pursuing thoughts is inferior. And then Yuan Wu says, if your own state is empty and tranquil, perfectly illuminated and silently shining, then you will be able to confront whatever circumstances impinge on you with the indestructible sword of wisdom and cut everything off. Everything from the myriad entangling objects to the verbal teachings of the past and present. Then your awesome, chilling spirit cuts off everything, and everything retreats of itself without having to be pushed away. That's a very important point. Everything retreats of itself without having to be pushed away. This is what happens if we simply absorb ourselves in our practice. We don't need to push thoughts away. They'll retreat. They'll recede on their own if we just give ourselves completely to this practice we're working on. If the basis you establish is not clear, if you are the least bit bogged down in hesitation and doubt, then you will be dragged off by entangling conditions, and obviously you will not be able to separate yourself from them. How can you avoid being turned around by other things? When you are following other things, you will never have any freedom. Here too, There are other ways to interpret it, but the most obvious is thoughts. When you are following thoughts, you will never have any freedom. If you are the least bit bogged down in hesitation and doubt, this is the most crippling of the hindrances in meditation practice. But it's really just a thought or a pattern of thoughts. Doesn't matter. It's still nothing more than thought, a doubt. The important thing when one is having doubts is to see them as thoughts. That's your way to pull free of them. See them for what they are. Goes on, the ultimate path is simple and easy. It is just a matter of whether you abandon things or pursue them. Those who would experience the path should think deeply on this. There it is again. Secret to practice. Are you going to abandon, let go of your thoughts, or pursue them? All right, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.